This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The political landscape in the Palestinian territories, particularly the West Bank, could change dramatically this coming fall. Municipal elections there could see power shift from the Fatah Party, which has been in control of the Palestinian Authority for generations, to Hamas, which is widely considered a terrorist organization. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about what this could mean for Israel and how it could fulfill a prophecy in the Bible. China's military buildup in the South China Sea has a lot of other nations concerned. Vietnam is doing something about it. It appears they've started moving rocket launchers onto five bases in the Spratly Islands. It's a pretty bold move that represents an escalation of tensions between these two nations. Some Western analysts applaud the move, but Trumpet writer Callum Wood says they aren't looking at the whole picture. We'll talk to him about why we should keep our eye on this situation. Why are food allergies increasing? More and more people are developing food sensitivities and allergies. We're going to talk with nutritionist Jorg Mardian about why. We'll learn just what allergies are and what steps you can do to prevent them and to cope with them if you have them. And I'll conclude the program by telling you about a haunting trip I took to a World War II battleground. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. If you think American politics is a brutal business, you should take a look at Palestinian politics. This coming October, the Palestinians will hold municipal elections, and the two main parties, Fatah and Hamas, are in full campaign mode, which means that they're pretty much coming to blows. Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall says that what's happening in the Palestinian territories could actually hasten the fulfillment of an important biblical prophecy. We have him with us via Skype from our office in the UK. Hello, Brent.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by just talking about why these elections are being held.
Well, they actually haven't been held for quite a long time. Municipal elections haven't been held for 10 plus years. The last election that involved both Hamas and Fatah, both Palestinian factions, took place back in 2006. And I no doubt people would remember that event because it was very shocking and surprising because most people thought, including Fatah, who had led the Palestinian Authority for a number of years, they thought that they would have a clean sweep and win the election. But in fact, it was Hamas that won the election, and especially in the Gaza Strip area, and they virtually took over the Gaza Strip after that point. Now, since that time, for a decade, Fatah and especially their leader, Mahmoud Abbas, have been worried to hold elections because they might lose once again to Hamas. Now, Fatah, they still are in power over the West Bank, even though they have conceded the Gaza Strip. And that is the far larger territory. It's got more Palestinian civilians as well there. So they're worried that, or they were worried, that holding an election like this could open the door for Hamas to regain or gain a foothold in the West Bank.
So what changed? Hamas definitely has more, they have more popular support among a lot of Palestinians. A lot of Palestinians view them as having more legitimacy because of their stricter adherence to fundamental Islamic principles.
Right. Yeah, well, it is interesting because there were municipal elections back in 2012, and they were called again by Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, but Hamas did not participate because they didn't want to, at that point, convey that they were in cahoots with Israel to a certain extent. They didn't want to be a part of the Israeli system in the West Bank whatsoever. So earlier, a couple of months ago, Fatah's leader, or a lot of the senior sources inside Fatah, they thought that Hamas would do the same thing again. So they were going to call municipal elections and give the appearance of democratic rule, give the people the opportunity to vote once again for their town's leadership. But they thought Hamas would not run. They thought they would boycott. And what happened is Hamas surprised everybody and said, no, in fact, I think we are going to run this time around.
So suddenly Mahmoud Abbas faces some opposition that he wasn't expecting. And given Hamas's popularity, this really could be, this could signal a sea change in Palestinian politics.
Yeah, and this is something that a lot of the leadership inside Fatah are worried about, not just Mahmoud Abbas. I have a quote here from a senior Fatah source, and he was talking to Breitbart. This was last month when Hamas announced that they were going to participate. And he said that he told Breitbart News, the divisions within Fatah, the infighting, the flagrant corruption, all of these will serve as ammunition for Hamas and it will not fall on deaf ears. So what he's saying is for years, there's been rampant corruption within the Palestinian Authority. There's a lot of money that's given to the Palestinian Authority. They're given more money per capita of the people that they're over than any other organization on the planet, foreign aid. And yet, where does that money go? A lot of that money does not reach the people. And therefore, because of that reason, and because of the fact that Mahmoud Abbas is, I think he's 88 or something like that, he's quite old, and there's even jostling within the Fatah for a new leader that they're starting to throw each other under the bus, that the party's in chaos and people are going to easily go over to the Hamas side. At least that's what's expected, even by a lot of the Fatah people.
I'm trying to understand, how is it that Mahmoud Abbas can decide when to hold elections or when not to hold elections? He was supposed to be out of power some time ago, but somehow or other he's managed to hang around.
Yeah, I think he was meant to be out of power about 6 years ago. That's when his official term ended. But he's still there. I mean, there's a lot of people that are saying, well, why is he still in power? Why hasn't somebody else come up? But how he legitimizes his continuation of his rule is that the situation isn't ripe enough to hold those parliamentary elections yet. There's too much infighting within the Palestinian Authority. It's the situation with Israel hasn't improved, and it just feels like it's too dangerous to have another election, which is basically every strongman's way that they hold on to power after their term expires.
So can you just give, say, uninitiated listeners an idea of what we're talking about, the difference between if Fatah is a cronyistic and corrupt political institution that continues to somehow the international community keeps working with them and funneling aid to the Palestinians through them and so on, but it's a party in chaos, what are we looking at when we talk about Hamas?
Right. So it doesn't make sense to keep on funding the Palestinian Authority and Fatah, it seems, on the surface. But then you have to look at your options. They only have their two-party system. There's some independence, sure, but they're never going to wring power away from the two huge power groups, that is Hamas and Fatah. And Fatah is the more moderate of the two. They do work with the Israeli government and the Israeli security apparatus inside the West Bank to ensure that Hamas terrorist cells don't take root inside the West Bank, because Hamas is openly espousing the destruction of Israel and work towards that end. They have not even accepted the Jewish state's right to exist. And if you just take a look at it, even if you look at the territory that Hamas controls right now, the Gaza Strip, where is the most dangerous place in Israel to be bombed by a Palestinian or rocket fire to hit Israel? It is around that area of the Gaza Strip, because that's what Hamas does. The town of Sderot, it's got 20,000 people, and it sits right. You could see basically the Gaza Strip from Sderot, and that town has been under a barrage of rockets ever since Israel left back the Gaza Strip in 2005. And what people are worried about is if Hamas gets in power of the West Bank, where Fatah is currently in charge, you're going to have a Gazification of the West Bank, which would be extremely dangerous for Israel, because the West Bank borders Israel's major population centers. Instead of just hitting this town of Sderot and the city of Ashkelon to the north of Gaza Strip, you could have these rockets raining down on Jerusalem, on Tel Aviv, on Haifa, because the West Bank is so large and most of Israel is within reach from the West Bank's borders.
So we really are in a position where we could see Hamas gaining a considerable amount of political clout in just a few months.
Exactly. Yeah, this isn't a parliamentary election, but you are, if they are allowed to, if this goes ahead as it seems, you are going to see a lot of the town's leadership and the city's leadership, all the Palestinian cities, the 2 million Palestinians that live in different places in the West Bank, come under the authority of Hamas. And it won't turn into Gaza immediately. It's important to make that point, because the Israeli security was all through the West Bank. The IDF, they still take over the security of a lot of places in the West Bank. They're all pulled out of the Gaza Strip. So they can't allow Hamas to have the same access to weaponry and the same freedoms to work as they do in the Gaza Strip in the West Bank. Even still, though, you are going to have the ideology of Hamas that will be pushed, and no doubt you will have increased terrorist actions as well. And that's the worry, that although it's not for the leadership of the Palestinian Authority, that would be the next step that comes after these municipal elections.
So project ahead for us here. First of all, we're looking, it seems to me like this is pretty likely that we can foresee what the scenario is going to play out like in the next few months. What would be the odds of someone frustrating Hamas from being able to have a victory in those elections?
It all depends really whether Israel, I feel, steps in and doesn't allow this to take place. Mm. Because they can see right now the polls have it running about 50-50 between Fatah and Hamas. The polls were wrong last time. And that's the worry. Israel, they're trying to weigh up. I mean, do they stop a democratic election from taking place in the West Bank because it's going to amount to Hamas being in power? And they may do that because of the risks that they face, and they don't want Hamas there because they're still a huge terrorist organization. But what you might see is the increased pressure on Israel to allow it to happen, because the world champions democracy and these people should have a voice and they should vote in who they want to vote in. And the Palestinian Authority under Fatah hasn't been that successful at bringing peace. So maybe the international community will allow it to happen or pressure Israel into allowing it.
So looking at the scenario that plays out from that point, you said that this won't happen immediately, but you talk in this article that you've written on this subject about a biblical prophecy that we really, that this kind of shines a spotlight on. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah, very much so. This is something we've been watching for, a Hamas takeover of the West Bank, right? On the very eastern, or the western part of the West Bank, is the city of Jerusalem. And the West Bank actually hugs up to half the city of Jerusalem. And there is a specific Bible prophecy that in Zechariah chapter 14, verse 2, that talks about half the city of Jerusalem going into captivity and falling out of Israeli hands. And even though Fatah has been in power in the West Bank for such a long time, that half of the city hasn't fallen. And the editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine has written that he foresees a Hamas takeover being the only way that they are going to have the impetus, the Palestinians, that is, to take that half of the city of Jerusalem, fulfilling part of that prophecy.
And that prophecy in Zechariah, it's something that he has written extensively about in his booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. Take us through what that implies, or what happens or what unfolds after that occurs.
Yeah, so again, this is why it's so exciting to talk about this and to watch this prophecy come to pass, because in that verse, there's a three-step process that leads right up to the return of Jesus Christ. And the very first step in that prophecy that starts this kind of, well, that triggers this series of dominoes to fall, is half of Jerusalem falling. So we know that once that happens, that we are on a countdown. There is a limited amount of time before Jesus Christ is going to return. And this is the very first sign and first phase of that prophecy.
So he's really talked about the half of Jerusalem being taken, being a trigger to that countdown. And what you're suggesting is that what we see happening politically within the Palestinian territories could well be that trigger.
Exactly right. Yeah.
All right. Well, we sure appreciate your time and letting us know about this. You have an article up on the website. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal, and this article is called The Coming Arab Takeover of East Jerusalem. As he brings out in that article, this is something that we have drawn attention to repeatedly in the trumpet based on that forecast by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, written up in Jerusalem in Prophecy. You can find Brent's article as well as that booklet by Gerald Fleury on thetrumpet.com. If you're looking for that booklet, just go under the literature tab and you can find that among all of the booklets that are printed there. Jerusalem in Prophecy, a fantastic read for anyone who is interested in events within the Middle East. It really does put those in perspective. This article really helps to bring out just how these current events are pointing toward the fulfillment of the prophecies written in that booklet. Again, Brent, thanks for your time.
No problem.
Voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China has been building up its forces in the South China Sea, locking down control of this critical sea trade route. Well, last week, aerial surveillance showed that some rocket launchers are being moved into the Spratly Islands, not by China, but by Vietnam. It appears Vietnam is trying to defend itself against Chinese aggression, which says quite a lot about America's presence in the region, and it gives us some clues about what may happen in the future in Asia. Trumpet writer Callum Wood has written an article about what this really means. We have him here via Skype from Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Our pleasure. Well, start by telling us about just the relationship between China and Vietnam.
Well, the relationship between these two, I guess you could say over the years, it's been quite frosty. The two haven't seen eye to eye on a lot of issues, especially in the South China Sea. This is not the first time that tensions have been very high between the two nations. In the past, there's actually been conflict that's led to the deaths of a number of Vietnamese soldiers and Marines when these spats between Vietnam and China on some of these contested islands. So the two have had a long history of conflict and tension. Yet at the moment, the trade ties between the two are stronger than they've ever been. So it's in some ways it's a balancing act, you might say. They have their hostilities and their differences, their disagreements. But at the same time, Vietnam knows the importance of China as a regional player, and they've been open to a lot of trade. I think China is now Vietnam's largest trading partner. So the Vietnamese know the importance of a trade relationship with China, and they try to balance that alongside their regional aspirations and goals and territorial claims as well.
So the fact that Vietnam appears to be putting rocket launchers on the Spratlys, this is definitely something that a lot of people would look at as being directly aimed at counterbalancing China's recent moves there. There are some Western analysts that say that, well, that's a good thing for Vietnam to be standing up to China. Why would they look at the situation and say this is good, this is a good move on Vietnam's part, or this would be advantageous, say, from a Western standpoint?
Well, a lot of those analysts, they look at it and they see what America's trying to do. Now, the Americans, they obviously want to counter China's rise. We've seen the US try and fail to a large extent to pivot towards Asia, as we've heard, away from the Middle East and put more focus on the Asian region. We see America trying to build its ties with Australia, with the Philippines, with its regional allies there, in the hope that it can create a bulwark or a force against China's rise to counter that, to keep Western influence really high. And so the fact that Vietnam is suddenly moving rocket launches into the Spratly Islands, which is one of these contested regions, it looks at a surface level to be a great thing for America, because suddenly you've got nations in the region that are willing to take a stand themselves. And so that costs less money for the US. It takes less effort for the United States. It's one region now that the United States can look at and say, yes, we've got allies or close friends at least that are taking a stand now and helping us out by arming the region, by creating a stronger wall of defense against China's rise and against Chinese belligerence in the region. You know, we've seen the Chinese moving ships in and its navy being very aggressive to the regional players there. And to see Vietnam actually say, hang on a second, we're ready to arm the region, arm our bases. I think they have 5 bases that they've moved these rocket launchers to. To see them do that, well, the US has said, this is fantastic. Someone else is finally on board with our policies, and they're taking a stand against the Chinese.
But that seems to be really giving a high praise to Vietnam as a check against China. It seems like to put Vietnam in the category of someone that could really stand up to China is really giving them a great deal of credit.
Well, that's exactly right. They are, realistically, the Vietnamese are and no match for the Chinese power. But I think perhaps a lot, these analysts, what their reasoning is that if Vietnam will do it, then maybe it might spur some other nations in the region to do the same. We know that coming out of Washington, certainly, there's some criticism of what Vietnam's doing. When they were questioned about it, White House officials actually said, well, you know, we encourage all regional players to de-escalate the tensions and to look to diplomacy rather than a military stance like we're seeing from Vietnam. But I think, yeah, a lot of analysts, perhaps more the right-wing analysts, might say, you know, this is a good thing. You know, maybe Vietnam arming these bases, perhaps that will spur some other nations in the region to also take a stand, and alone Vietnam might not be a cause for concern for the Chinese, but if its arming of the region might cause other nations like Indonesia or Malaysia, Philippines, maybe they'll look at this and say, well, if now we've got the Vietnamese arming up, well, maybe we need to do the same as well. It might spur a few of these other nations to start arming and being a little bit more aggressive towards China.
So in your article on thetrumpet.com, Rocket Launchers in the South China Sea, you argue that this actually reveals some other things about the region and about America's presence there that really should give us pause. Certainly give anyone who would view this in wholly positive terms pause.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason for this is, as I sort of touched on briefly there, the message coming out of Washington, D.C. is not one of support for this sort of action from Vietnam. Washington, the Obama administration, they really have been trying to push de-escalation and trying to push diplomacy. And what we're seeing from Vietnam is really completely the opposite. So the arrival of these rocket launchers, it doesn't necessarily speak to the support that the United States is getting from nations in the region in their efforts to calm things down in the South China Sea and smooth out relations with China. It's actually speaking quite the opposite. If Vietnam is willing to put rocket launchers in when the United States is saying, let's look to diplomacy instead, well, it shows that there's this real fracture in the way that China's actions are being perceived, or at least the way to counter China's actions. Because if the US is looking to diplomacy, well, these other nations, clearly Vietnam, doesn't believe that's going to work. Otherwise, they wouldn't be escalating tensions. They wouldn't be moving rocket launches to the South China Sea.
So this is really for Vietnam to be stepping out and taking this action, say, contrary to America's encouragement to handle things diplomatically. This really shows just how tense the situation in Asia is becoming in absence of America's presence. We've talked a lot about how other nations in the region, specifically the Philippines, Hong Kong, South Korea, Japan, how they're all trying to grapple with a post-American Asia and recognizing that they're having to deal with China on their own terms and really can't rely on American security guarantees. This is another piece of evidence illustrating that trend, it would appear.
Exactly right. I mean, Vietnam, they're looking to the future and they're saying, well, we're seeing China, it's not being stopped right now. We're seeing the United States backpedaling or looking to diplomacy when diplomacy is clearly failing, or the Chinese simply aren't listening. The Chinese, they're ignoring court rulings and international court rulings, that is, and just pursuing their own policies as if nothing has changed. And Vietnam can see that, and you know they know their position. They know that they're not nearly strong enough to counter China. And not only that, they know their geopolitical weaknesses. Vietnam, for instance, has miles upon miles of coastline, and with the military the size that it is, there's no way that they could possibly defend all of that. And so their best step is to defend the islands out in the ocean and try and create somewhat of a buffer zone to China and to its aggressive policies. But going back to what you said, yes, they see exactly what's going on. They know that the United States is pulling out, and that's why they need the rocket launchers there. They can't trust in America to be there to defend them anymore. And especially when we see Washington coming out and saying, well, we call on everyone to de-escalate, because the Vietnamese know if they de-escalate, well, chances are China's not going to listen to a single word coming out of Washington.
Well, in so many of these Asian countries, we see a push and pull between the imperative to defend themselves and to rely on their own military abilities to do so, and the recognition that China, just like you said about Vietnam, really could easily overpower them. They really don't have the wherewithal to defend themselves militarily against China. So there's a real need for them to join them if they can't beat them. What's happening here? Here you've got Vietnam making a fairly provocative move on these islands that would suggest that it's willing to take a more aggressive stance against China. But ultimately, it seems like for it to stand up with any real force against China isn't going to be a long-term strategy that it would be able to use. Eventually, it's going to have to accommodate.
That's exactly right. As you mentioned there, if you can't beat them, join them. And that's the case that Vietnam is now facing. They're going to have to wake up to one of two realities, really. They're going to have to either eventually come to the point where they realize and understand that America's not going to help them. And at that point, they also have to realize that alone they have no means of standing up to China. And so, do they take and one might say almost suicidal stance against them in a hope that they might somehow hold the Chinese off, or do they join them? It seems the more logical answer to them. Historically, we've seen the smaller nations, they've relied on America, a relationship with America, a relationship with Australia, bigger nations to maintain their independence and to maintain control of their territory. But you take away those larger nations, those protectors, and suddenly you've got little nations like Vietnam, which really have no means of themselves to defend themselves against China. Well, now they're facing the outcome where, well, they ultimately they have to join China if they're going to maintain their security.
So we talk about this from a biblical prophecy standpoint in our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, and listeners can get a hold of that if they go to thetrumpet.com and look under the literature tab that really puts all of this in context. But we are looking for a unification among Asian nations behind a Russia-China alliance. A lot of these other nations getting on board, and in so many of these places, we're seeing something of an arms race where there's quite a strong military buildup that could actually at some point be combined in an Asian alliance, and these nations that are kind of building up militaries to defend against one another could pool them as a means of addressing as a common army outside threats. And it seems like Vietnam could easily fit into that prophetic picture the way that you're looking at it right now.
That's exactly right. And while Bible prophecy doesn't state the exact ins and outs of how this group is going to be formed, how these nations are going to come together, Vietnam's actions could easily lead there. I mean, as we've already spoken about how inferior the Vietnamese military is and how it really doesn't have much of a say against China. It couldn't really take a stand on its own. And so moving rocket launchers into those islands, well, that's a pretty provocative act. It might come across the wrong way to China. China might react to that, and we might see something like we saw back in the 80s when the Chinese and the Vietnamese had a fight there, and it led to the deaths of a number of soldiers, as I mentioned earlier. And so it really could blow up in Vietnam's face if they're not careful, if they act too aggressively without the backing of the United States or strong allies that could support them in a future conflict. So that's one way it could certainly lead to China taking a more aggressive stance against Vietnam and ultimately leading to either conquest or forcing Vietnam into some sort of arrangement or agreement. But, I mean, it could go any number of ways. I mean, we could see if America's power continues to decline in the region, Vietnam could easily take a step back and acquiesce to China and allow them to have more of a regional influence in Vietnam or in the South China Sea. And at that point, those rocket launchers, they slowly stop being a counter to China, and they start looking more like aggression against America, against American interests, especially if these nations start entering into an alliance. Then all of a sudden you have the weapons there. The weapons are already in the South China Sea and ready. And yes, Vietnam's a small nation, but if you consider that on, say, a larger scale, with a nation like the Philippines, which has a far larger military, or Indonesia or any other nation in the region, the same principle could apply. These nations, they all have their own militaries, and right now they have their guns pointed, so to speak, towards China. But slowly but surely, as America pulls out, as American power declines, well, these nations, these weapons are slowly going to start pointing away from Beijing and probably pointing more towards China's enemies as these nations all reconcile in the face of a weak America and a strong China.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood. He's written an article called Rocket Launchers in the South China Sea. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Callum.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In the last couple of decades, there's been a steep rise in food allergies. What is going on here? Why would foods that should be perfectly healthy for us create problems for so many people? And in the past, this was something that was more rare, or maybe somebody would be allergic to one food. Now it's common to see people allergic to many types of food. Why were people not suffering from this in generations past, and what is it that's changed that's making us so allergic in today's world? To talk about this via Skype from his office in British Columbia, we have holistic certified nutritionist Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello, how are you?
Good. So, first of all, maybe you could just explain what is happening when our body has an allergic reaction to a food that should be nutritional for us?
Well, that's the key, right? You know, when you look at an innocuous meal and it becomes sort of a loaded weapon, that can seem terrifying to people because the repercussions can be quite nasty. The immune system really believes that a food is dangerous, a certain protein in a food, and produces the immunoglobulin E antibody in order to neutralize it. Now, what happens then is chemicals such as histamine and other chemicals are released into the bloodstream. And really what happens is you produce an exaggerated internal and sometimes deadly, or an exaggerated external, I'm sorry, and sometimes deadly internal response. You could actually choke and lose your life. That would be a drastic response, of course, but it has happened.
So the body says this is bad, even though it's getting bad information, or it's interpreting that food incorrectly, and it's treating it as if it's something very dangerous, and it's that body's reaction to the substance that's creating the problem.
That's right. It's what the food is doing to the intestines, really, that's bad. And you know, when we look at this, as science really looks at it and says, well, why are we getting allergies at all? They really don't understand it. And there's a lot of ideas that abound with that. I think some of the top ones would be the hygiene hypothesis. It's the idea that rising rates of allergies mirror or declining exposure to bacteria. And that makes us prone to otherwise harmless substances. And then there's some other ideas, such as the increasing rates of vaccination that is going around, as well as agricultural chemicals and perhaps even genetics. And again, there's nothing definite. These are ideas that are floating around. And surprisingly, an overlooked aspect in the fight against food allergies has actually been food itself. Now, we know what the triggers are. The triggers are eggs, cow's milk, peanuts, tree nuts, seafood, sesame, soy, fish, and wheat. Those are the most common triggers. But we don't know why they do it. And there's a book out that I was reading. It's called The Unhealthy Truth by Robin O'Brien. And she says that in the United States, it's one of the only developed countries in the world to allow hidden toxins in our foods. And toxins that are increasingly being blamed for the increasing rises in food allergies and diseases in children. So a lot of this happened, she says, with the introduction of the Flavor Saver tomato in 1994. That was the genetically modified tomato. And since then, we've really reached a critical junction with genetically modified foods, because they've been shoved onto the public without meaningful debate, without long-term animal studies, without government tests, and without labeling. And they really want to do all of this now without letting the public know at all what's going on in their food. And surprisingly, 70 to 75% of processed foods is now genetically modified or has some ingredients that are modified.
And you're saying basically science hasn't shown definitively one way or the other what kind of effect this has on it, but it sounds like you're saying, or this author that you're citing has traced the increase in allergic reactions to the introduction of GMO into our food production.
That's right. I mean, there's been a 265% increase in hospital admissions since that time for food allergies. And so we're seeing a corresponding increase in people going to the hospital with the introduction of these foods. And the problem with these foods is that they've never been tested. It's just been said they're good for us. They're the same as normal foods, but there's been no meaningful tests.
So is the correlation enough? Is that all we have to go on, or is there actual proof of causation?
Oh, there is. We have, there was a study in 2011 at Sherbrooke University Hospital in Quebec, Canada, and it did show correlation, finding that the BT toxin, that's a toxin that they're actually putting into, it's a pesticide that they're putting into the plants so they don't have to spray. And the insects, when they consume that, it basically just bursts their gut and kills them. It's not immediate, of course. But now they find this BT toxin in the blood of pregnant women and their fetus and fetuses. So we do know now that it does indeed go into the bloodstream. And in 2012, the Journal of Toxicology showed that BT toxin causes leaky gut. Now, that's huge because that's what BT's aggressive mechanism was designed to do ruthlessly, to perforate the gut.
Right. Bugs, but not people. But you're saying it happens to people, too.
Well, what is a poison? A poison does one thing ruthlessly. It kills. And it really doesn't make any sense to say it kills one species but not the other. We're much larger, but we do consume more.
Can you explain what leaky gut is?
Well, leaky gut is really when you have toxins and when you have foods that are undigested actually leaking through the gut lining and into the blood. And then the body attacks that as an allergy. It's just it's not supposed to happen. That's not the way the body's designed to. It's supposed to pass through the body. And so we have these proteins that are actually going into the bloodstream and the body's freaking out and having this response. And a lot of times it's not that bad, depending on how bad the condition is, but you can actually die from this. Mm-hmm. So now we have a lot of conditions. You know, we have fibromyalgia, we have a lot of rheumatoid arthritis, we have perhaps autism that's linked to that. You know, there's a lot of conditions that we say, well, are they separate conditions or are they a condition of this? And they're showing now that they're saying, well, perhaps that a lot of the conditions, we really don't know how they start, could be the cause of this.
And you're talking about this toxin that's placed on the produce that the pregnant woman is eating, that is introduced into the bloodstream of the infant. The child is born and is more susceptible or maybe even already has food allergies. Maybe you could just give us a sense of how widespread allergies are becoming.
Well, they are becoming widespread because, and here we go with the genetic cause as well, right? They're saying, well, perhaps there is a genetic component to it. Well, that's how we could perhaps trace it to the genetic component because these babies are born with that. Now, this food allergies really, when we look at how widespread, they've become the fifth leading chronic illness in the United States with up to 15 million people affected, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So it's not a small problem at all.
Well, I wonder, there are obviously those who say have very strong, violent reactions to peanuts or some substance like that. How many people are suffering allergic reactions that are more mild? Maybe they just don't feel well for this reason or that. They just kind of pass it off. It's not a big deal, but it is food allergy or it is leaky gut that's causing the problem.
Well, that's the thing that's baffling doctors now. There's so many symptoms of people go out there and they say, look, I've got headaches, I've got aches, I've got pains, I've got inflammation. And really, a doctor can't pinpoint things like that. He can only say, well, I can go according to the symptoms you have and give you something for it. But how do you pinpoint that? And that's what they're saying. It's so prevalent. The BT toxin is so prevalent now inside of food already, inside the genes of food plants, that there's no way to stop this anymore. Basically, if you're eating foods that are in a can or a box, you are eating genetically modified foods. And you really are. That's the first time in history, first time that pesticide toxicity inside cell walls is being sold for human consumption. And so, of course, it raises the possibility if that eating BT-containing produce might damage the human digestive tract in the same way that it does to insects.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. What do you do about it? How do you, if you're suffering from food allergies or maybe you suspect that it's food allergies that are causing some of your not feeling so good, what do you do about it?
Well, there's a wonderful program called the GAPS Nutritional Program, G-A-P-S, capital G-A-P-S, and it's by Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride. And that can be looked up online, and that's really made specifically for leaky gut. And it focuses on removing the damaging foods and replacing them with healthy alternatives so that you give the intestinal lining a chance to heal and to seal.
So this is specific nutritional prescription. Get rid of these foods. Introduce these foods to repair the gut. Can you maybe give us a bit of an overview of what her recommendations are?
Sure. A lot of the foods are just based on a wholesome diet, based on unprocessed, ideally organic or locally grown foods cooked at home. It really is a common sense approach, but I think that if people are used to a processed diet, they might find it hard. Mm-hmm. But that's the way we need to eat to be able to give the body a chance to heal. And these foods form the foundation of which the immune system can function and thrive without allergies always interfering. And it's really good to give that a good try. Give it a good try for a couple of months, and then you'll start to see good results.
You gave a list earlier in our conversation, a list of the foods that tend to give people the most problems. Maybe you could just give that list one more time, and then I have a follow-up question.
Sure. The most common triggers are eggs, cow's milk, peanuts, tree nuts, seafood, sesame, soy, fish, and wheat.
So is it a good idea to just say, well, let's try eliminating these and see how we feel?
Oh, it always is. I mean, eliminating these type of foods can be hard if you're used to eating a lot of, say, dairy products and a lot of wheat products. But if you're suffering, it really doesn't make sense to take them off the diet, because a lot of these reactions, many people don't even know they have a food allergy, because the allergies aren't that bad, but they do build up over time and it gets worse and worse. And then people don't put two and two together. So it's sort of an elimination diet. You look at these foods and you say, well, what if I take out all of these foods and perhaps introduce one or two and to see if that one would be the cause. If not, then take out another one, you know, and just play with that list. But a lot of people really, like you were saying in the introduction, they're allergic to three or four different foods. So You really should make a good effort to take this list, eliminate it if you're suffering, and just see how your body reacts. And usually it's quite favorable.
Now, there are people who maybe they find that they can't eat, say, normal wheat products that are marketed in the store, but they can have certain kinds of wheat that aren't genetically modified, or maybe they don't have a problem with raw milk, even though they may have a problem with, you know, pasteurized milk or that type of thing. Is that common to be able to find the right version of a product and that doesn't exacerbate the allergy?
I think the only way that you can know for sure anymore, because there is a big fight going on right now with lawmakers about eliminating labeling for genetically modified foods. And in the end, it's sad to say, but they might win out. So the only way you can really know is to say, is a food organic or locally grown by somebody I trust? If not, you just don't know if it's genetically modified. If it is organic, then it's not allowed to contain any genetically modified ingredients.
Is there anything that people can do to prevent developing food allergies? How far do you have to go down this path if you're not really suffering food allergies, but how might they develop if you're not careful?
Well, the best thing to do is to eat as clean as possible, to eat a whole food-based diet. The biggest triggers are the processed foods. I mean, you're getting junk. You're getting, besides all the, you know, the salt, the sugar, all the chemicals and all of that, now we have to face with genetically modified ingredients. We're becoming more aware of them. If you're eating processed, there's no way you can eliminate the garbage. But if you're eating whole foods, you know, more vegetables, more meats that are based upon local farmers that you know, which is how we get it. We go out of our way to get our meat from somebody, and we go out of our way to get our vegetables. We grow a lot, but whatever we don't have, we'll go to a local farmer and we'll say, hey, do you grow naturally or organically. And it really isn't that much harder to do. It does take some more work, yes. But the biggest thing I would recommend for people is not to eat processed foods. You can pretty well be assured that you're going to get some kind of symptoms. You know, you can get overweight, you can get really sick, you can get leaky gut. I mean, there's a whole lot of symptoms. You will get something because that's not a whole food and it's really unhealthy.
We've been talking about allergies with nutritionist Jörg Mardian. He's working on an article on this subject for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that online. Always interesting to talk with you, Jörg. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
It jarred me the way those hulking relics of war stood starkly against the tropical foliage. Demolished, pockmarked concrete, surrounded by beautiful, lush green plants. This is Corregidor, Island of Antithesis. This small island fortress in the Philippines was the setting of some of the most dramatic scenes of World War II. It simultaneously symbolizes bravery and betrayal, humanity and hatred, strength and savagery. Gazing across the scene, I was bombarded by incongruous images and emotions. But the biggest collision in my mind was between the epic past and the uncertain present. After it captured the island from Spain in 1898, the United States built a major military outpost on Corregidor. The Rock bristled with guns and mortars, a total of 23 separate batteries. Yet Corregidor was also a soldier's paradise, with a sandy beach, golf course, baseball diamond, opulent cinema, lavish officers' quarters, and excellent barracks, housing thousands of men, all against a backdrop of the calm waters of Manila Bay. Most of these impressive installations are still there, but now they are skeletons, bearing the garish scars of the horrors they endured. Of those enormous barracks filled with soldiers, only empty concrete shells remain, interlaced with rebar that holds sagging chunks of staircases and walls aloft in twisted formations. Gaping holes and mounds of rubble mutely testify to the furious Japanese aerial bombardment. The theater is roofless and hollow. The swimming pool is a cavity carpeted with vegetation. The ruins still reverberate with the voices of the soldiers who occupied these structures, who manned these munitions. Every blast hole brings to mind the men whose bodies were also blasted and battered when the bombs fell. Buried in the center of the island lies Malinta Tunnel, a colossal bunker complex that the Americans drilled into a mountain over the course of a decade. The wide but dank passage now serves as the setting for an audiovisual show telling the story of its construction and use during the war, MacArthur turning it into the USAFFE headquarters, the Philippine government taking refuge there, and the unfolding of the most shameful chapter in America's World War II history, the betrayal in the Pacific. 10 days after attacking Pearl Harbor, the Japanese descended on the Philippines, America's possession. President Franklin Roosevelt immediately proclaimed his, quote, solemn pledge, backed by the entire resources in men and materials of the United States, that America would come and safeguard the Filipinos' freedom. MacArthur skillfully evaded Japan's powerful clutches, evacuating U.S. and Filipino forces to Corregidor to make a stand until reinforcements arrived. But the solemn pledge was a blatant lie. The help never came. Allied forces on Corregidor eventually succumbed to Japanese butchery, and surrendered on May 6, 1942. The presentation well conveys the terror of those days, with sounds of enemy planes buzzing outside, of bombings that shook the tunnels, of the voice of President Quezon lamenting, "How typical of America to writhe in anguish at the fate of a distant cousin, Europe, while a daughter, the Philippines, is being raped in the back room." Then the radio announcement from the Voice of Freedom. Despite the Allied forces' superhuman endurance in the face of overwhelming odds, Bataan has fallen. But the spirit that made it stand, a beacon to all liberty-loving peoples in the world, cannot fall. It was galvanizing, yet gut-wrenching to hear, knowing the hellish death march those captured soldiers afterward endured. The next wave, I felt, was one of redemption, hearing how America partially atoned for its treachery when it fought back for the Rock 3 years later. On the island's topside hill is a field too small for an airborne combat landing zone, yet this is where hundreds of daring men parachuted down from just 400 feet, descending directly into a cauldron of fierce close-range warfare. These tough men, who knew both the nobility of sacrifice and the brutality of killing, were the liberators of Corregidor. A short walk away is the Pacific War Memorial Museum. There I stared at the black and white portraits of the officers who had orchestrated the offensives and commanded the troops. They seemed like superior men, serious, manly, steely, intelligent, men of character, men who inspired men. I felt small. I tried to comprehend this conflicted past. These ruins impressed me with what the men did here, yet I could not escape the whole truth. Like every battlefield, this was just another horrid chapter in human war-making, another place where high rhetoric clashes with the low things human beings do to each other. These ruins are oddly relevant to the present. Their hollowed hulks evoke the decline of America. As Moses prophesied long ago, the pride of its power has been broken and lies in rubble. Only the facades remain. 3 generations after what proved to be America's last unequivocal military victory, the U.S. presence in the Philippines is only an echo. America's reputation is mortally wounded. Its ambition has shrunk. Its unprecedentedly superior military is oddly impotent against the most pitiful of threats. It all makes Scripture's most shocking prophecy seem far more conceivable. When the next world war breaks out, America will shrink all the more, and horror will spread over the globe virtually unchecked. I walked beyond the Memorial Museum to a rotunda. There I saw words chiseled in stone that finally reminded me of hope. "Sleep, my sons, your duty done, for freedom's light has come. Sleep in the silent depths of the sea, or in your bed of hallowed sod, until you hear at dawn the low, clear reveille of God." I look forward to meeting them when that dawn comes. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Callum Wood, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Henry Ford. If you think you can, or if you think you can't, you're probably right. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.